I'm Bill Littlefield. As you've likely heard by now, Aaron Hernandez committed suicide inside his prison cell earlier this week. The former Patriots tight end was serving a life sentence for a 2013 murder. He had been acquitted by a jury in two other murders. And that's where we're going to begin this week's Three Stories You Should Know. Joining me are WBUR Shira Springer and Mike Pesca, the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you, Bill.
Mike, you're up.
So I don't know how much of a sports story this is, but of course Aaron Hernandez is known to us for his time with the New England Patriots. And there were two stories in the news that had parallel elements. One was Hernandez, which you just recounted, and then there was that horrible story, the Facebook killer, a guy named Steve Stevens. And the parallel elements were these were two murderers who wound up taking their own lives. And there were differences. The Facebook killer was on the loose, on the lam, therefore his suicide may have given with it a measure of relief to Cleveland. However, in covering Hernandez, ESPN, all the other sports outlets, they talked about the tragedy of it all, the sadness of it all. I don't think that's inappropriate, but it did strike me as totally different than the Steve Stevens coverage, which the tragedy was only extended to his victim, his randomly selected victim. It just got me to thinking about who we think of as real people and how we begin to process a crime as something other than the act of an evildoer, but the act of a person. I don't know if we were being too sympathetic to Hernandez, too unsympathetic to Stevens, or somewhere in between, but I just was struck by this question of humanity, even of a person who is a murderer.
Shira, are you also struck by the distinction between the way people react in those two circumstances?
Yeah, I am struck. And I think part of the reason it happens is because Aaron Hernandez is sort of three-dimensional in the way that we think of him. We knew him from a very young age as a football star. We saw his rise. I think another aspect that might explain some of the fascination and the difference is that prior to his murder conviction, he was living a life that many people dream of. And so there was a sort of a way in which people related to Hernandez that, again, made him a person of real fascination.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think it's the fact that we invest celebrities with our dreams, and kids want to be them, and they grow up thinking, this is what I want to do with my life. I don't think anybody grows up thinking, I can't wait to become a psychotic murderer. Oddly enough, though, one sports writer who knew Hernandez pretty well told me that he felt one of the issues with him was that he always wanted to be the toughest guy on the block rather than a really great football player, and that was apparent fairly early on. Wrap this up for us, Mike.
I think that's a very good point that you made, Shira, that when we say I can't understand it, it's not just how I can't understand one man killing another, but we project ourselves into his place of wealth and seemingly having it all. But I also think we say tragedy. Now, in dramatic terms, what's a tragedy? It's a story where the protagonist dies. And so for us, Hernandez was the protagonist, whereas the other set of stories were just thrust upon us. It was kind of a random collection of elements.
If we want to be academic about it, a tragedy also requires the hero who dies to have fallen from a great height. And I think you could make that case with Aaron Hernandez.
Yeah.
I want to talk about a new policy at Indiana University. It bans athletes with histories of sexual or domestic violence from playing sports there. I'm quoting now, any prospective student athlete, whether a transfer student, incoming freshman, or other status who has been convicted or pleaded guilty or no contest to a felony involving sexual violence, would not be added to any sports team at Indiana University. The intent of this new policy, I think, is laudable. It'll be interesting to see how it's actually applied. It sounds as if the coach would not have the discretion to say, well, yeah, but I got this kid and I can really bring him around and I can help him become a mature, good citizen. I like the idea of eliminating the discretion and actually having a policy in place. I'm wondering if either of you think that this could be counterproductive in any way.
No, I don't think it could be counterproductive. I mean, I think it's a step that we should see across the landscape in college sports, because there have been cases where players have transferred from one school to another where they have committed some either violent act or sexual assault at the one school they were at previously, mm-hmm. and then they get onto a new campus and they reoffend.
Mike, you good with the Indiana policy?
I think I am, because of where we are with this issue. On the other hand, there are a couple examples I could think of where this would be an injustice. Remember Marcus Dixon, who was convicted of statutory rape in 2003 or 2004. He was a Georgia high school student. Essentially, his Vanderbilt scholarship was revoked. There were a lot of racial elements to the prosecution, and the NAACP and Marion Wright Edelman came out against it as a form of legal lynching. And I also think how toothless are presidents and athletic directors where they have to make a specific policy so that you are banning an established policy, as opposed to telling your coaches, who should be your employees, you shall not do this. And I do believe in redemption and I do believe in second chances, but I'm also smart enough to know that those ideals are trotted out 99 out of 100 times just as an excuse to get the edge rusher who maybe is not of high moral character on campus. So given the reality, I think it's a policy that I have to sign off on. But it underlines just how sad the problem is.
Shira, my understanding is that you are bringing to the table a topic somewhat less serious than the ones we've just discussed. Please.
Hard not to be.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say a low bar has been set. Well, the Chicago Cubs, the reigning World Series champions, are discouraging team employees from selling their championship rings. How are they doing this? If someone tries to sell those rings, the Cubs are reserving the right to buy back the ring for $1. The $1 buyback is not a requirement put upon uniform players, just the part-time employees, the full-time employees, and the seasonal employees. Basically, the Cubs want the people who receive the rings to cherish them, not to use them as a saleable asset. I get that, but it's a gift, and the people who receive the gift should have a right to do what they want with it. I'm thinking of the employee 5-10 years down the road who needs cash. Maybe he doesn't have enough money for retirement and would like to sell his World Series ring. Also, another key fact for me in this whole thing is that the Cubs are giving out 2,000 rings. That's an awful lot of rings to keep track of. I think that is an obscene number of rings to be given out.
That doesn't sound like a gift, does it? That sounds like they've created a situation where I'm an unwitting lessee. I will say this. If the Cubs in 1908 put one ring in the bank at compound interest, that would be at 5%. That would be 195 rings today.
I can't really see anybody standing up for the idea that the Cubs should be able to buy these rings back for a dollar. This feels to me like a violation of personal freedom.
Would you feel any differently if the buyback wasn't $1, but it was for market value?
Yeah, if the Cubs had said, if you ever want to sell this ring, you have to give us the right of first refusal, I would have said, yeah, sure, that's fair enough. They don't want them out there on the open market.
Yeah, here's the thing. I think we'll be hearing about this 5-10 years down the road. There is going to be someone
Absolutely.
Within the organization who falls yeah. on hard times.
One of those 2,000 people is going to
exactly.
have a tough day.
I will say this was actually brought up to a Cubs spokesperson, and that spokesperson said, you know, we're hoping that if that happens in the future, we can work out some financial arrangement. But then again, what does that mean? Does that mean they get $10,000 for the ring when they could get $50,000 for it on the open market? It just seems destined to be a source of controversy that lingers way into the future.
All I know is I am instituting this policy with my Christmas gifts. No regifting. I get to buy them back for $1.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and WBUR's own Shira Springer, who also contributes to the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.